This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho, featuring inspirational and fascinating personal stories of people from all corners of the globe who are now in St. Louis. We'll take a look at the U.S. through newcomers' eyes, get some insight into world history and cultures, and maybe learn something about ourselves. Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans here at News Talk STL. This is kind of a special episode for two reasons. One reason is because it's going to be my last episode, at least for a while. I'm going to put this show on hiatus for a while, and I'm going to start doing a music show here at News Talk STL, in which I'll be playing a lot of 1970s music, and I'll kind of leave it at that, but it's going to be a really trip down memory lane. I hope people of a certain age like me might find the show interesting. I'm going to be calling it Groovy Grooves, and that might tell you something about it, but stay tuned, and hopefully you'll like that. You'll hear more about that as time gets closer to the date, but in honor of this being the last show, at least for now, I've got a special guest, and she's not really a new American. She's American, but not new. I've got Sister Paulette Wyndell. Welcome.
Thank you.
And she is often referred to as the Mother Teresa of South St. Louis because, among other reasons, she worked for, 25?
Over almost 30.
Almost 30 years, gosh, in the refugee support ministry at St. Pius Church in South St. Louis and South Grand. And I work with her for some of those years, not all of them. But I thought it would be really interesting to kind of wrap things up. We've talked to people from many other countries, and Sister Paulette has met and worked with and helped people from many of those countries. So I wanted to get your story, kind of your personal story, but also a lot of words of wisdom from you about working with refugees over the years. So I always ask, the first question I usually ask people is, where were you born? Where is your country on the map? But where were you born? Where is your country on the map?
Well, I was born prior to Second World War in South St. Louis in the Carondelet area, which at that time was all farmland.
Wow.
Small farms. We called them truck farms. Mm-hmm. I believe like in Kenya, they might call them shambas. Mm. And my great-grandparents had a small farm that had a mule and chickens.
Wow.
And my father was able to buy a portion of their farm and to build our home. So that's where I grew up. And so it was like living in a village.
Wow.
In the city.
Yeah. And you had a large family, too, right? How many siblings?
There were 10 of us. I'm the second oldest. I have an older brother. I have 6 brothers and 3 sisters. 2 of my sisters have passed away. So it is a big family.
Wow.
And a lot of nieces and nephews.
And how many bedrooms in this house?
Well, it started out with two.
Oh my gosh.
Two bedrooms. And as the family grew, my father and his father, my grandfather, converted our attic into a big dormitory.
Mm.
And then later on, there was a smaller room for the girls. Mm. And it was kind of interesting because they built it in such a way that some of the beds were under the eaves. So there was more room up in there.
They use every inch.
Every inch.
Wow.
So.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, I'd like to talk more about your childhood, but I want to jump a little bit ahead because there are so many stories about your ministry. But I did want to ask, how did you get the calling? How did you decide to become a sister and go into the ministry?
Well, it was very gradual. I think when I was about 7 years old, I met a sister who was so kind and generous, and I wanted to be like her. So that was the beginning of an attraction to becoming a sister. And also during that time, there were I experienced a lot of deaths. My little sister died, and 2 of my young uncles had died. And so that was another seed that I wanted to do something that was meaningful. But it grew, and it wasn't a vision or anything like that. So it stayed with me until I graduated from high school, and then I decided to try. Mm-hmm. And so I'm still here.
And did you go into the community thinking and hoping that you would be working with refugees, or did that just sort of—
I had no idea. No.
Did you have a particular idea of a ministry when you went in?
No.
Were you even given a choice, I guess?
I figured I would be a teacher. Most of us were teachers.
Okay, that was teachers. Like a teaching—
teaching community.
Okay. So what was your first position after you finished your—
Okay, I taught school at St. John the Baptist Catholic School in Delore. I was there for about 7 years. I loved it. And then I was assigned to San Antonio. I taught in San Antonio. And I also, for a year, I was in Austin, Texas, where I worked as a volunteer at Mount Carmel Clinic, where I first met many Mexicans who were patients there. And it was very interesting because I knew Spanish. I didn't know any Spanish. Mm-hmm. But I was able to communicate. So that was another seed.
That was a seed.
That was the beginning of an interest.
Yeah. And then how did it finally come to— St. Pius is where you worked. But before you worked with refugees, you had another ministry there too, right?
Yes. I was at St. Pius for 10 years. I worked with elders in the neighborhood, and I got to meet people who had been refugees from the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 and from some former refugees from the Second World War. They were telling me their stories.
You talked about the one family from Ukraine.
Yes, Christine Swishuk. Yeah. Yes, I met her in 1980, and she told me the whole story about the terrible things that happened during the war and about the famine and— yeah. That her father and brother were taken to Siberia. Mm. One brother was killed as he was escaping. The father eventually, he was also a priest in the Orthodox Church, and he did return. But so I got to know Christine and her family very well.
Now, when you came to St. Pius, you were not— this was not a teaching position at first.
No. It was what we call parish ministry.
And was that your choice, or did your community assign you there, or how did that come about?
It came about as a volunteer. I volunteered there one summer when I was in between jobs, and I liked it.
Okay.
And I liked it very much, so.
Did you need to get permission from your superior to do that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, of course,
okay.
Yes.
And then you worked with elderly Americans, basically. But then how did your ministry kind of— I think it was gradually shifted.
It was very gradual. My life is very gradual,
yeah,
as you see.
Me too.
One day, at that time we had a priest that was staying there from Uganda who was going to school. Mm-hmm. And one day he told me that he met a man from Eritrea on the bus and I should visit him and his family. And so I did. That was 1984.
Wow.
And I got to know this family very well, and I still know them. We're very good friends now. It was Fiore, Tesfai, Michael Mahari. And through them, then I met many people from their country.
Eritrea,
and got to know their situation and what was happening in their country. And that's how it grew. But it was— as I was continuing to work with elders.
And I think the neighborhood demographics were kind of changing too, right?
They
were. Because that was down where the International Institute was, and they were placing refugees there. And at the same time, a lot of the older people, I guess, were passing away. And right, so you had fewer of one and more of another group to minister to.
Right. And then in 1990 is when I met another family that I've become very close to.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about this family. I think
yes,
I know you're talking
but
about.
But everything was kind of gradual.
Yeah.
And learning is going.
Yeah. Well, who was that family? Was that— that's Kimon, right?
No. In 1990, it was the Da Silva family.
Okay, I talk about the— actually, I interviewed two of them
on
the show recently.
You did.
How did you meet them?
Well, I met them one Sunday when I was at Mass. And we have a custom that we make this, have the sign of peace at Mass. And I turned around and I never saw these people before. So after Mass, I ran after them to find out who they were. And then I visited them. And that's when I began to see what the situation was again, mm-hmm. when they're resettled and what the needs were. And
what were some of the needs? Had they just recently come at that point?
They had been here a few months, but they were still the house was not adequate for their needs. They didn't really have what they needed. They needed a different place to live. Mm-hmm. And so gradually we were able to accomplish that through a network of people. Mm-hmm. It was just not one person. You have to network a lot.
Yeah, you do. And then I think we started getting a lot of Vietnamese in the late 80s, early 90s, and that's really kind of what pushed you over the edge, right?
That was it. Yeah, well, sort of, yes. In 1992, this is when there was a great influx of Vietnamese who were coming through the HO program, which meant that these were the men had been in prison for at minimum 5 years, and they were given permission to come to the United States with their wife and unmarried children under 21.
Now, these were men who had worked with the South Vietnamese Army with us, right?
Yes.
And then, therefore, when the communists gained control, they were...
They were put in re-education camps, which really were concentration camps. I heard many, many stories about this.
Yeah.
And so they were here with their children.
Yeah.
And the other group that came at that time were the Amerasians, which were children of Americans.
Yeah. And American fathers and Vietnamese mothers.
Correct.
Can you talk about what they survived and faced in Vietnam?
Oh, yes. From stories that I have been told, you know, they were called the dust of the earth, and they were children of the enemy. Mm-hmm. They were not allowed to go to school. They were very poor. The mothers, if they were caught with American children, they were persecuted and mm-hmm. sometimes killed. So these children were abandoned, basically.
Many of them were
extremely poor. And then when they were given permission to come to the United States, they became what they called the gold of the earth, because they had a ticket to come to the United States with their mothers and their families.
As refugees.
As refugees.
Clearly we did have responsibility for people.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're our children.
Yeah.
Yes.
So they could come with their mother, but I think sometimes some people up to no good stepped in.
Yes, this was unfortunate. Some of the children were bought.
Well, they were kind of unofficially adopted, is it?
Unofficially adopted. They would pay the mother if they could bring their child and pretend that they were the parent. And this was relatively easy to do because many of the names are the same.
Yeah.
So sometimes what happened when they came here, some of them were abandoned here.
Yeah, that was really horrible.
That was terrible. So these children who never had any education were kind of on their own.
Yeah.
And they were like teenagers by that time.
Yeah.
So
that's how I got involved with working refugees.
You got involved with that time, yes.
What were some of the other countries that had people that you worked with in those early days? What were some of their countries? Eritrea, Vietnam, Angola?
Angola, yes. Well, there were many African countries that, as time went on, let's see, there were people from, I'm trying to think.
Well,
here.
I think there were... Cubans, some Afghanis, Ethiopians.
I think they came a little later. I think mostly from West Africa at that time, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire. There were many people coming from there, mm-hmm. got involved with some of those communities. And then Congo, Somalia.
That came a little bit
later. They were later. Yeah. In the beginning, it was primarily Liberians that were coming.
Yeah.
So we got to know many Liberians at that time.
Now, did you have to get permission from the powers that be to formally change your ministry to working with refugees?
Again, it was a gradual. My life is gradual. It was a gradual turning over. It was a change of pastors at that time. And so I was still working with some elders and then trying to form a social concerns committee that was kind of assigned to me, and then also working with refugees. Yeah. And so eventually we were able to just focus on the refugees and immigrants.
Something that you welcomed? Were you? I'm sure it was overwhelming and emotionally draining and everything, but was it something that you wanted to do?
Yes, I was extremely interested in the people that were coming and what their situation was and how we could help them feel at home because they lost their home, they lost everything.
Yeah,
and so it was a gradual unfolding. So we got a lot of people who were networking to help, because a lot of people really want to help newcomers.
Yeah.
They really do, but they don't know how. They don't know where.
Yeah.
And so, as you know, we start making a lot of connections with that.
Why don't we take our first brief break here, and we'll come back and we'll pick up the story in just a minute. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL. Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Arnell's Hardwoods. For all of your laminate and hardwood flooring needs, call them at 314-397-3252.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by the Indoor Comfort Team. For all of your heating and cooling needs, call the Indoor Comfort Team at 314-230-9542.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans. We're talking to Sister Paulette Wendell, a.k.a. the Mother Teresa of the South Side, talking about her years of working in refugee ministry in South St. Louis. And gosh, I've got so many questions. Let's talk about who you call your boss. Kim An.
Okay.
She's a Vietnamese lady, and I think I mentioned that the Vietnamese were coming in large numbers then. And how did you meet Kim An? How did that all start?
Okay, so one day there was a knock at the door, and there was a young—
At the rectory.
The rectory, the priest house, where our offices were. A young woman knocked at the door. She was about 17, 18 years old. And she said, my mom needs help. Can somebody help her? And
she was Vietnamese.
She's Vietnamese. So I went, of course, and I met a wonderful woman named Kim An Tran, and her husband Sang Win. And that was the beginning of a very long relationship. Kim An spoke some English because she worked at a PX during the war. And so she introduced me to every Vietnamese that resettled in South St. Louis.
She's not kidding. This is true.
And it was wonderful because I do not speak Vietnamese, so she became my boss.
Well, she also warned you about who to help and who not to help, because she knew who some people. You know, most people were okay, but there were a couple who tried to take advantage of.
She would tell me who's not telling the truth,
yeah.
Because who? How do we know? How do I know? And so she would always tell me, no, yes, no. And she became my boss.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I learned was that you do not ask questions directly. Mm-hmm. when we went to somebody's house, we were supposed to kind of just see what they needed and then do it.
Yeah.
So that was something new. She also, like I said, tell me who's who and what was going on. And she's very, very active in the Vietnamese community, extremely active.
When you want to organize anything, just tell Kim on and she'll.
Yeah, she's right there. She's right there.
I think in those early 90s, 75% of your ministry was with Vietnamese, right?
Absolutely.
Because they were the largest group coming in at the time.
It was the largest group at that time. She
was your interpreter, basically, too,
she
right?
She was my interpreter.
And your cultural liaison.
Yes.
Because we all make mistakes.
A lot of mistakes.
We make a lot of mistakes. Put our foot in our mouth.
In fact, one time I had an intern from St. Louis University who was working with me, and I said, you know, I need a sign that says I'm sorry in many languages.
I remember this.
And she made this big plaque for me that said I'm sorry in many languages.
For everything I have said and will say and didn't say.
Yeah, but I think because we were so interested in wanting to assist that people forgave us a lot of our mistakes, as I hope we forgive.
Yeah.
Give them too.
And the other communities, did you have interpreters for them too from within the community, or how did you communicate?
Well, I usually found somebody who just appeared in that community who spoke some English. Mm-hmm. And so again, they became my boss.
Your boss, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because they could tell me, who was in need, and we would go visit and see what we could do.
Yeah.
And as that time went on, we were making connections with churches outside of the city because people needed a lot of help at that time.
What were some of the needs that they had?
Well, basic needs in terms of their housing, interpretation, medical. Medical was a big deal. Dental was huge. There were issues with the police, and how do you communicate with the police? Because many of them that came had very bad experiences with authorities, and so they would not report different situations that needed to be reported. Mm-hmm. Just about anything that deals with life is what they needed.
Things like furniture, too, right?
Oh, furniture.
Finding people jobs.
Right. And at that time, because the community was pretty young, there were a lot of babies being born, and so there were a lot of needs.
Diapers.
A lot of needs regarding babies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
So it's just what anybody needed. We would try to do it and making connections with other agencies that were also sprouting up at the same time.
Did you have a budget?
You're laughing. No, there was no budget. But my community, the Sisters of the Most Precious Blood of O'Fallon, Missouri, they were extremely generous. We received grants. In fact, you received a grant so that you could work part-time.
Yeah.
And also Sheikh Noor Hassan, a Somali man who was a great leader in his community. My community was also able to give him a grant for some time so that he could really assist the Somali community here.
Yeah.
And then another great grant provider was Barb Xavier, who is now with, what's it called?
Places for People. Yeah.
She came on board and she knew how to write grants.
Grants, and we did a lot of fundraisers. Yeah, I met you at a fish fry in like 1991 during Lent, and you told me about what you were doing, and I thought, I was teaching full-time English then, and I thought, wow, that sounds really interesting. Do you need any help? And I think you said, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing either. We'll figure this out together. Come on down. So I started volunteering. The first thing I did was work with the Amerasians that you talked about. That was the first project. But I really felt like this was my calling. That was my niche. And so
I
volunteered with you for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. But then your community actually provided, I worked there full time for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to the generous support of your community. So that was great for me. And so we didn't have a budget, but God always seemed to provide. We would, you talked about the doctors and the dentists, and we would, you know, talk to our dentists about doing some pro bono work, and we'd bother other dentists and doctors. And
yes, one of the dentists is Dr. David Borgmeyer.
Yeah.
And Dr. Borgmeyer would go to Mexico every year to help the people there with dental problems. And at one point he said he wasn't going to go anymore because we were sending so many people to him.
And you, you had no qualms about using the sister card to lay some guilt on him or other people too.
Well, but he's been so generous to help people with their dental issues. That's his big problem.
Well, another doctor, Dr. Flavin was another dentist.
And Dr. Marino helped.
But then, I remember, if you said that when you came on, would take you or somebody would take you to visit a new family, and you'd sort of quietly look about to see, oh, they need, I don't know, a coffee table. They need dishes. They need blankets. So we didn't have a budget, so we would just call around and ask if anybody had anything they wanted to get rid of. And we would eventually, people knew about us and they'd call us when they had furniture or something to get rid of. So then we had to find a truck to schlep it. I'm getting tired thinking about this stuff now. But really, really grunt level.
Just basic human needs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And what was your mission statement?
Oh, as we develop it, gradually we were forming into a solid ministry. Well, the first one was to welcome, to be a welcoming,
welcome,
and to assist, to advocate, and to accompany. And yes, and so I think we really worked hard at that, to do that.
Yeah.
Even today, we still accompany people.
Yeah. No, that's a big part of it. It's important to give them dishes and furniture, but I think what you were so good at was even if you didn't have anything to give them tangibly, you sat and listened to them, you gave them a cup of tea, you talked with them. And that, I think that's maybe even more important.
Yes, and I've gone to many weddings. Mm-hmm. And funerals and graduations, and they become family. Family is very important to me.
Yeah.
As you started this interview, my family is very important.
Yeah.
And I think of these folks that are here without their family, without an extended family.
Yeah.
And that is so, so hard. We rely on family for all kinds of things, and they don't have that support. So that really touches my heart.
And, I counted one time. I've lived, I think, in 14 different places in my life. And I think that's typical for a lot of them. I mean, that includes college and everything. But I think a lot of Americans don't think twice about moving across the country for a job or something. We're a new country compared to these other countries. And we're more mobile. But I would say the vast majority of the refugees that we worked with, their families had been in that town or village for hundreds of years, and they had, they knew everybody in the village. They had family there, and they were just kind of ripped out of it and plopped down in South St. Louis with, a completely, not only the language, but all the culture is different, the weather, the food. And I had to keep reminding myself of that fact because, if I had to move to Illinois because of, God forbid, ethnic cleansing or something, would be a drag, but I could do it. But, they had to leave everything they knew and come halfway across the world.
Yes, and I think my experience as a young child living in the village that I described before, where we knew everybody and it was a safe community, I kind of related to that. And also because of my large family, we depend on each other for many things. Mm-hmm. I really sense that their loss.
Yeah.
That they don't have family.
Now, how did you find people to help? I guess they found you. It was kind of through word of mouth, or you didn't really advertise, did you?
No, there was no need to advertise. there's a wonderful network among the people, the different groups that came. It's amazing. No, they just appeared. They just appeared, and I got to meet some wonderful people, faith-filled, resilient. I have learned so much from the folks that I have met. I actually became part of their family. Some of them, especially we're talking about Kim Ahn, she was pregnant when she came, and
that's why her daughter called you over.
To help her, and so the wonderful thing about that is that when her little daughter was born, it was an emergency. So I had known from a past experience that this was serious, and I rushed them to the hospital. And little Teresa was born, and I was honored to be able to name her.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. I was honored to name her, and so her Vietnamese name is Thao, but she is Teresa. And the reason I chose Teresa is that when I was about 10 years old, my mother said that I could name the next child. If it was a girl, I could name her, and I wanted her to be Teresa.
Really?
And then my mother had four boys.
No fair.
So Teresa is... it's my godchild and my grandchild. So I became part of their family and was able to go to Vietnam with them.
Yeah, I want to hear that story, but we need to take another short break. And I don't want to start that and make you stop. So let's take a quick break now. And I want to hear all about this trip to Vietnam. That was a great experience you had. We'll be right back. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL. Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Samim Afghan Restaurant, featuring traditional Afghan cuisine and conveniently located on Manchester Road in the Grove.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you by Hacking Law, for individuals who want to come and stay in the U.S. Hacking Law fights for immigrants every day. Visit them at hackingimmigrationlaw.com.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL. We're talking with Sister Paulette Wendell, and you were just about to tell, until I rudely interrupted you, about your chance to visit Vietnam with Kim Ahn and her family.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience. We lived in they're from Vinh Lam in the Mekong Delta. We went there during a Tet, which is a huge celebration, New Year celebration, met almost everybody in the hamlet, lived with her family. I was, of course, I didn't understand anything, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know Vietnamese, but I was well cared for. And I was so, so in amazement about what I learned and who I met, and it was one of the things that startled me was that even at that time in 1998, I had to turn over my passport to the local village police, and that was a kind of a surprise to me, and that at Tet, the flags had to be out. Every house had to have a flag. And if they didn't, they would be in trouble. So it was pretty tight at that time, too. I was also very much aware of my brother and some of my cousins who were in the war. And it was bittersweet.
A lot of different emotions. Different emotions.
It was wonderful. And having to live in the hamlet and not understand anything, it was a good experience for me because I could understand what it felt like or what it feels like when somebody comes here and doesn't know the language, but also the customs, what's proper, what's not proper, and not to understand anything that's going on.
Yep.
So that was so valuable. I will never forget it, and I'm always grateful that I had that opportunity.
Wow. Yeah. We were talking off air about this frontline group that we started in those days. You want to talk about that?
I would like you to talk about that.
Well, it was, you know, as we mentioned, we didn't know what we were doing. We were just kind of flying by the seat of our pants. So we thought we'd learn from people that knew better. So we would, I think it was like once a month, we would meet for dinner at some restaurant on South Grand. We would meet with people from the International Institute and Catholic Charities and other groups that worked with refugees just to share information, encourage each other. And then that was very good. I mean, I think we were able to all help each other and help each other to help.
Yes.
But then you wanted to talk about some of the other agencies that kind of sprang from this.
Yes. So one of the big needs that we saw at that time was the need for medical care for refugees. And at that time, I had an opportunity to go to Albuquerque for a conference. And there I met a nurse who was in St. Louis, of all places, her name, Christine Roloff. And we got to talking about the need. And so at that time, she worked for Deaconess Hospital and tried to get somebody there interested and was not able to for a variety of reasons. But anyway, somebody knew about Sister Betty Brooker, Franciscan Sister of Mary, who was the head of the hospitals. And, things moved very quickly. At that time, we had to narrow our focus from all refugees to the largest group that was here, which happened to be the Vietnamese. And so there was a clinic that was started. And actually, in time, it morphed over into St. Francis Community Services. And part of it is still in operation. Sister Hin, a Vietnamese sister, is the head of the Vietnamese program at St. Francis Community Services. And Mr. Sang Nguyen, who I mentioned before, was working there for a long time. So the connections were wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
The other group that started at that time was the Immigrant Refugee Women's Program by Sister Elise Silvestri, a Notre Dame sister, who saw the need for helping women in the home who could not get to classes. And she started the program that now is called iHelp.
Yeah.
So it's still continuing, and it grew from a small operation to a more formalized program.
Mm-hmm.
The other group that started about that time was the African Refugee Immigrant Service with Zed Manali from Eritrea.
Ethiopia.
And that grew from all this. What was exciting was that and LAMP also, we needed interpretation because children were interpreting for their parents in the medical setting, which is children don't understand, and it was not good, but you had to do what you had to do. So the Language Access Metro program also started around that time and now is flourishing and is useful.
Yeah, in those days, I don't think St. Louis was ready for this influx of refugees.
No.
I mean, as a city. No. Like interpreters was one example. Now we're in a better place. Another area was mental health. I think a lot of your people were probably, they maybe didn't articulate this, but they were clearly suffering from PTSD based on what they survived. So did you refer people to places?
Well, at that time, there was another sister of St. Joseph, Sister Jean Abbott, who was very concerned about the trauma that people were suffering. And she started a program called the Center for Survivors of Torture and War Trauma. And that also grew and developed, and I believe right now it's part of Bilingual International Services.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that it starts as a seed or a small concern, and it grows and develops.
Yeah, as people became aware of the needs, they tried to meet the needs
right
with whatever resources we had. And then also, don't forget the War Trauma Recovery Project.
Right.
That started, that literally was,
that was
incubated at St. Pius.
That was incubated St. Pius, too. That started at that time, too. And also around maybe a bit, little bit later, you know, people have all kinds of immigration problems, too. And there was, I was at a meeting, and I had given a talk at out in the county. I forget the church right now. But a man came up, and he was a lawyer. And he said, "Do you need any help?" Well,
yeah,
that is not a question. I mean, yes, of course. And he's was a retired lawyer, and he continues to help until this day. And he's helped a lot of people with legal problems. Mm-hmm. And so it was like people would hear about what's going on, and they want to help.
Yeah,
they want to do something, and there was always something to do or create your own. Yeah. And that's how it kind of grew. And it was just great.
There's so many things I want to talk about here.
The Christmas.
You want to talk about the Christmas party? Yeah, we did an annual Christmas party where we would find sponsors to adopt families for Christmas. You want to talk about that?
Well, yes. What can I say? We got to know so many people, and we were learning that there were so many people that really wanted to help. And so I think we did like 300.
For the last few years we did it, we had over 300 families sponsored. We would connect. We would get them. That's how many families were coming in those late 90s. With like 25 or 30 families a month were coming in. So we would try to connect them with sponsors. We get high schools and churches and synagogues and businesses to adopt a number of families.
Yes. And two of the schools are still very involved, St. Louis U High and Nerix. Yeah. Those two were we introduced them to St. Francis Community Services.
Yeah.
And so they continue to serve them.
Yeah.
A wonderful outreach to them.
You know, it just when you look back, all these things, just you talk about gradual. This was gradual, too. But as people, I think you're right. People want to help, but they don't know how, or they don't know, even know that there is a need. But when they find out, they really want to help.
Exactly. Exactly. the other, besides the Christmas outreach, for a while we had what we call the African Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
And this was wonderful. At that time, there were many different Africans from different countries.
Yeah.
And we started out at St. Pius.
Got too big for St. Pius.
Got so too big and went to St. Louis University at that time.
No, that was wonderful. We'd have people from, I don't know, every probably country. 20 or 30 different African countries, and they'd bring food from their country. They'd wear their traditional clothing. It was wonderful.
It was great, yes.
Oh, gosh. You want to talk about the Mayor Hunger Project?
Well, I'll just briefly, at that time at St. Pius, there were priests from different countries that would be able to stay there and then continue their studies. There was a priest that arrived. His name was Father Joseph Kiberia from Meru, Kenya. We got to know him very well, and he would tell us about the situation in his country. And so we started a project that we felt could help the farmers, and we called it the Meru Hunger Project. And Barb Xavier was one of the movers and shakers in that project. And because of this project, we were able to go to Kenya in 2004 to see the project.
Well, you raised money to buy the land and buy the farming equipment and machinery, right, to get the people out of the...
Well, yes, and it was successful for a while. We had some wonderful donors who... Really, I don't know if I can mention his name or not, but he was very instrumental in this project, too. But due to the drought, and they had swarms of grasshoppers, and it didn't meet our expectations of success, but it did for a while. And I think it was kind of we didn't know it at the time, but it was really based on microfinancing, that whole manner of assisting. We didn't even know that at the time, but actually that's what we were doing.
Yeah.
So that was the Mayor Hunger Project. Thank you.
We have to tell the carpet story.
Okay.
Now, you and I have told this story a million times together. You always get it wrong. You always forget details, so I always have to jump in. But this is the best story of all times. Do you want to start?
Sure. So once a week or once a month, people from Annunciata Parish would come to assist us. They were wonderful. They're St. Vincent de Paul Society. Well, one day a woman wanted a carpet. She needed a carpet. She was from Afghanistan. She needed a carpet.
Meaning see what I mean? I'm jumping in, sorry.
I'm used to this.
These are important details. So she was looking for not a carpet, like not a wall-to-wall carpet, but just like a rug, because she was living in an apartment with a hardwood floor and she would pray on get on the floor to pray. And so she was asking for something to put on the floor. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you, Ron. This happens all the time. We were walking back to the rectory, and she said, "Oh, I really need this carpet." And I said, "Well, let's pray."
Now you're standing outside.
I'm standing outside.
You're back.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron.
See, these are important
details.
Thank
you, Ron.
Your back is to the rectory. You're facing her. Okay.
No, we're walking up toward the rectory.
Okay.
And then I said, "Let's pray."
Yeah.
I said, "Oh God, Yahweh, Allah." At that moment, carpets came flying out of the second floor.
Of the rectory.
Of the rectory.
Out of the windows.
Yes. And she looked at me.
Because?
She looked at me. I looked at her. And I said, "Are there any diapers up there?" But the reason they were flying out of the window is that they were taking up the old carpet and they were throwing them out of the window at that very time. And this woman, whose name I cannot remember at this time.
Her eyes got as big as saucers.
Yes.
She thought she witnessed a miracle. and she did.
And she did. So did I. And so she invited her friends, and they picked up the carpet.
But then word spread that you were a literal miracle worker.
I don't
worker.
Know about that. But maybe. I don't know. I hope not.
That's the carpet story.
That's the carpet.
Yeah,
and
prayed,
I knew
Sister
that
Paulette
you
prayed.
Would interrupt me.
I know, but sometimes you leave unimportant details. All right. I had to get that in. You retired, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you're still very active in these communities. I know you're working a lot with the Burmese community now. Right? Kind of as a volunteer.
Well, not so much.
But not as much with a few families. Yeah, but I mean,
yes.
you're connected with this
connected
community
with
right
them.
Now.
But can I go back a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, so another woman that I met, she's from Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Georgette Dijona.
Mm-hmm.
And fantastic woman. Heard her story and... she started a program in Burundi called the Burundi Miracle Project. She went back to Burundi. She's in her 80s. She went back to Burundi and is starting this wonderful program to assist the children that are orphaned. Part of the program is called the One Meal Program, where she and her staff feed about 600 children one meal a day. And again, my community has been supporting this one meal program for a number of years with donations. She is an inspiration to me, as are all, everybody that I've met mm-hmm. have just inspired me mm-hmm. so much.
Yeah. No, that's a great story. We're down to a couple minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, I mean, you and I both really had no formal training. Well, you had some training, but no formal training in like refugee ministry. What would you recommend to any listener that may find themselves with a neighbor from another country or a coworker or somebody that they see every day? How would you suggest they approach them, if at all?
Well, if it's a neighbor, I mean, to introduce yourself and welcome. Is there anything that I can do to help? Mm-hmm. We're glad you're here. It's just being kind mm-hmm. and open and curious. And
what about the language barrier? How were you able to get around that yourself if there was no interpreter?
Well, you pick up sign language, really. I don't mean
you make your own
official
sign language.
You make your own sign language. I think by being friendly and just not be afraid.
Yeah.
Not be afraid.
I think a sense of humor helps too.
A sense of humor, especially when you make mistakes, yeah. because and laugh at yourself.
Yeah.
And the children, if you could get to the children first, yeah. because the children are, you know, they learn English very quickly,
yeah.
and they can help introduce you to the parents
yeah.
and grandparents, and it's gradual,
yeah.
just little by little. Everything is gradual,
yeah.
evolving.
Yeah. Okay. Words to live by. Okay. It looks like our time is up.
Oh.
I know. It went by too fast. There's a million more stories I want to ask you. But thank you for talking with us. Thank you for all your years of service in the past and present and future to the refugee communities.
Thank you.
Mother Teresa of South St. Louis, Sister Paulette Wyndell. Thank you very much.
I enjoyed talking with you again, Ron.
Okay. And thank you for listening. This has been Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.